So we're going to be in Acts 23, but we're going to do a little bit of a review just to get us back up to speed of exactly where we are as we go into the passage here. So Paul's journey to Jerusalem, how has his journey to Jerusalem been? Now, I'm not talking just last week, but over this last missionary journey, the third missionary journey, how has the trip back to Jerusalem been for Paul?
Well, it was emotional because he met the elders of Ephesus, and that was quite an emotional time.
Yeah, yeah, right. And he was even saying to them he thought that it might be the last time he'd see them, right? Good. What else did Paul encounter in this last missionary journey as he came back to Jerusalem?
Lots of warnings that he's going to have chains and so on when he gets to Jerusalem.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to touch on that again, but that's exactly right. He not only did he have warnings, but he experienced, so he would see those things when he got to Jerusalem, but he experienced them all along the way, right? He had persecution everywhere he was going. He was being chased out of those places. And so he had difficulty, warned in multiple ways of the dangers in Jerusalem. And then was there any particular timing that Paul was seeking when it came to Jerusalem? That's right. And why was he going? What was Paul doing on that missionary journey as he was headed back to Jerusalem?
Wasn't he under a vow?
There was a vow that he spoke of. That's correct. Which is
bringing funds back.
Yes, right. Collection. He was bringing collections from the church, and he was actually bringing a lot of the church leaders all to come back and deliver those. And actually, in chapter 24, which we'll be looking at next week. If you look at 24:17, it says, "Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and present offerings." And it's interesting, we're not going to go into detail on this, but when he came back and he meets with James, do you ever see when he gives all the money to James? Do you ever read anything about that in chapter 22? Luke doesn't say anything about it. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that because that would often antagonize the Jews, because this is money coming from the Gentiles, and they would struggle with that. And so Luke doesn't even really mention it there. And really, we find out what Paul was doing related to Romans 15, he says it, and then in 1 Corinthians, he also talks about doing this same thing. So he comes back to bring that money. He comes and he meets James. And what's James' plan when Paul comes back? James is concerned, right? Paul comes, he tells him all that God's doing in all the churches, and James tells him he should do what when he's there? He was supposed to take some men with him and go to the temple, right? So that they would be pure and that he would represent himself saying, I'm still submitting to the Jewish law, because that's what the Jews had against him. Because what was out there was that he was telling Jews that they didn't have to follow the law anymore. And what was Paul actually doing when he was in the churches as he came back? What was he telling them in these Gentile churches and at the synagogues? He was telling them that the Gentiles didn't have to follow the law, except for these things, right? First time they had the council in Jerusalem, they wrote a letter and they explained what certain things, because they were trying to figure out, how do we merge these two things? How do we bring the Jews and the Gentiles into one church and honor one another and not set off sensibilities on either side? And that was a complex thing. That was a very difficult thing to do. And I think they really navigated it well, because they didn't leave nothing on the Gentiles, because they said, the Gentiles, you have to honor the Jews and the laws that they're submitting to. And yet, he wasn't saying all the law had to apply to the Jews. Quite the opposite. That didn't apply to the Gentiles. That wasn't needed for them. And so, trying to reconcile these two groups into this new body. And it's really, as we We're going to get into 24 next week, and we'll get into some detail of the case before Felix. But the struggle was, is this thing, Christianity, something new? Because if it was, the Romans would not be okay with that. And Paul's point is that, no, this is the fulfillment of what Judaism had promised, the promises to our fathers. So James' plan is for him to go to the temple and to bring these other men and pay for them to be there. And when they got to the end, when that time period was almost over, they end up having a group come in that says Jews from, it didn't say Macedonia, it said Jews from, let me go back and look. So in verse 21-27, it says, when 7 days were almost completed, Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying, "Men of Israel, help. This man is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place." And I'll stop there. And so all of a sudden he gets arrested. And we have these number of events that we walk through here that are going to bring us to chapter 23, in which they just grab him, they pull him outside the temple, and they're not going to have any kind of court case. They've already made judgment, and they're going to kill Paul. And the centurions come down, and they stop them from killing Paul because there's a riot going on. And that was a problem for whenever there were leaders in foreign nations, Roman leaders in foreign nations, is people having uprising. But there's a particular verse that I want us to look at, Acts 21:38. They're saving Paul from this crowd that's going to kill him. And as they're going, I'll actually start in 37. It says, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Now, I just want to make the point there that the tribune thought he was someone else, right? He wasn't sure what's going on. And that's really the picture throughout these two chapters. Everybody's trying to figure out why are they so angry at Paul? And we've seen in other places, in Ephesus, right? When everyone's in an uproar and they're in the town square and they're like, and they didn't know why they were there. They were just in an uproar and they were worked up. And this seems to happen here as well, where the people are saying different things, because he asked, what is it you have against him? And people are saying different things to the tribune. And so the tribune thought he was this leader of these assassins. These assassins are going to come up. We're going to talk about that in a few, about exactly who they are. And they actually had a big impact in Jerusalem going forward. So then when he gets permission, he gives a speech that at the beginning of 22, and he talks about his encounter with Jesus on the Damascus Road. Now that's going to be important as we look at, and we're really looking from verse 6 on what happens as Paul perceives the Sadducees and the Pharisees and why he says the things that he does. So he's allowed to give that speech, and then they go into chaos again. They want to kill him. They're asking for him to be killed, and they pull him out again. So the tribune was trying to figure out why is it that they hate this man, and the Romans would often have ways of figuring that out. They didn't necessarily. She actually got a bonus too, right? She's going to go in there with the sheet. They didn't have ways. If they couldn't figure out what was going on, they would beat somebody. I find it funny because they come and rescue Paul, who says is being torn apart by the crowd, and they put chains on him. It's like, he's the victim. Why are you coming and arresting the victim, right? But the tribune was trying to figure out why is it that Paul is hated, and so he is brought back, and they're going to flog him. And that's when Paul tells them what? You guys remember?
I'm a Roman citizen.
Roman citizen, exactly. And so just as we think back over the whole series, there are it's interesting when you look when Paul will claim I'm a Roman citizen and when he doesn't claim to be a Roman citizen, right? When he was in Philippi, he didn't say a word until they wanted to release him after they had done these things. But here, they had already bound him, which is wrong. You're not supposed to bound a Roman citizen. They're supposed to have trial first. So they've already crossed the line, and the centurions get very nervous when they find out he's a Roman citizen and saying, hey, what are you doing? And it actually literally says that they backed up from him because they were concerned about that they had broken the law. So now the tribune's stuck because his normal way of figuring out what the truth is, he would just beat him until he confessed something. So he couldn't find out from the crowd. He can't implement... So now he's running out of options of how he can figure out what is it why they're so angry at Paul. And so he's going to go to the Sanhedrin. He's going to go to the Jewish council and have this case happen in front of him so he can determine what is it that they have against Paul. Why are they so angry against Paul? So in chapter 22, verse 30, it says, "But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and set him before them." Which I find funny because they were all scared that he was bound, but they didn't unbind him until the next day. Like, I don't know, it's just funny the way that works and that. So they're going to bring him to the council. He brings him to the council, and like Andy was talking about last week, he says... He's talking about having a clear conscience before God, and Ananias has him punched in the mouth. And he responds back at him by saying, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall." Right? And we talked through some of that last week, and that brings us up to where we are right now in verse 6. So this is the promise, starting in verse 6. "Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope of the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial.' And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' parties stood up and contended sharply, 'We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel had spoken to him?' And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks." And so here's another time when they are rescuing Paul. They're taking him back from the Jews who are going to tear him to pieces. So if you consider Paul's trip to Jerusalem, the things that he's encountered all the time, often when he goes places, it is the Jews that are going after him, right? They actually follow him from Thessalonica, and they're going after Paul, and they're constantly challenging him, constantly calling him out. And he comes here, and he's attacked by them twice now, right, in a very short period of time. How would you feel if you were Paul about the Jews, where you're going and experiencing this over and over again? Think of it in light, just what Chris was preaching on this morning, if you apply it to us today. Sorry, one second. It was rhetorical. So think of it today of those that are on different sides of whether, I don't care if it's social justice, political, whatever, it doesn't matter, how quickly they become the enemy. So how did Paul view the Jews? Go ahead, Josh.
How did Paul view the Jews is a very different question.
Okay.
He viewed them as his lost brothers and longed for their salvation. At the same time, pursuing that, by bringing the Gentiles so the Jews would become jealous and come in as well.
Excellent. Would you grab Romans 9, verses 1 to 5? That's exactly right, Josh. And would someone else read Romans 10, 1 to 4 for me? Romans 10. You got it, David?
I am telling the truth in Christ, and I am not lying. My conscience testifies with me in the Holy Spirit that I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart. For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my children according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belong the adoption as sons, and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the temple service and the promise, whose are the fathers and from whom is the Christ according to the flesh, who is over all, God, blessed forever. Amen.
Thank you. And just before you read that, he talks about his brothers there. In Acts 22, verse 1, as he starts his speech, he says, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense I now have before you." In Acts 23, 1, he says, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in good conscience up to this day." And then in verses 5 and 6, he says, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest." And then in verse 6, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of Pharisees." He identifies with them. And I love in Romans 9 the anguish that he says he has for his brothers, for the Jews. And he writes this that written in Corinth after a time of them coming after him over and over and over again. Go ahead, David. Romans 10, 1 to 5, please. Or 1 to 4, I think.
"Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes."
Thank you. So I just as we start to look in more detail, this is a very detailed account of, there's a couple of speeches of Paul in the next few chapters of him having court cases. I just want us to hold in our minds how he felt towards these people. He didn't hate them. He didn't come at them, he didn't see them as the enemy. He said he would be accursed himself that his brothers might be saved. And it's kind of sobering to consider the persecution that he's experienced, that he would still have that attitude. I know for me it would be really easy to let it slip and just punish him a little bit, right, in the midst of this. And yet we don't see that from him. And so sometimes it's important as we look at how he responds to things. We're going to talk about his perception of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And it's really easy for us to just stand back and say, "Oh, nice manipulation. Good job. You really got them there." Right? It is for me anyways. I don't know about you. But it seemed like a very wise thing to do. And yet what Paul could win if he convinced them wasn't going to further the gospel. That's when Paul claims Roman citizenship, often it is in light of what's going to further the gospel. In Philippi, it was going to further the gospel for him to not claim Roman citizenship. So he would stand with those that were also being persecuted. And then he called out the authorities so that they wouldn't be persecuted later. That wasn't going to happen here. That wasn't going to happen in Jerusalem. And so as he says, "I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, it is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." So let me start with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. We're not going to do a deep dive on this, but the Sanhedrin were kind of the Supreme Court for the Jews. The Romans used them. They worked with them. Whenever they conquered, they would allow them to keep some of their systems in place in order to govern. And so the Sanhedrin were 70 plus the high priest. So they were 71 total is what they were supposed to be. They had this lower court that was like 23 people, but they were made up of various groups. And the Sadducees were the primary ones that made up the Sanhedrin. And it, I didn't have time to go in, but I can understand actually, even theologically, why that would be. Because they didn't consider an afterlife. They actually had a couple thoughts about what it might be, but they did not focus, and that's why he says that they don't have hope, because they didn't think about the afterlife. So if you're somebody that sees this is all there is, they're going to pursue power here. And that's exactly what they did. And they were very good at that. And they dominated the Sanhedrin. There were, I don't know what the percentages were, but there were a lot of them and not as many Pharisees or others that would be there. So they didn't believe in an afterlife, but it also says that they didn't believe in angels or spirits. Now, one of the things that Sadducees would say is that they hold to the written word. And they would say Sadducees hold to the written word. The Pharisees were okay with the oral tradition, and the Sadducees were not okay with that. Okay? But if they hold to the written word, and we'll just say Pentateuch for now, right? It's not exactly true that they didn't believe in angels. One second. It's not exactly true that they didn't believe in angels, because we see that even in the Pentateuch. Right? Yes, sir.
I'm just sort of curious. I understand this concept and I've heard it before. But how, it just seems strange to me that they would have gained such a high position within the Jewish religion leadership when they didn't believe anything that was scriptural.
Great. Well, I wouldn't go that far at the end, but great.
Well, I'm an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I went too far off.
Yeah.
But to deny these aspects that are mm-hmm. just rife with throughout the Word of God in the Old Testament, how could they have gained that position?
All right. That's a great question. I don't know for sure. The first thought that comes to my mind, yes, sir?
Weren't they the lawyers? Weren't they the experts in the law?
They were, but there were others that were doing that as well. They were. You know, you had the scribes as well, but...
Well, that makes it even worse.
Well, see, the thing is, this is the part that's really ironic, is that the Pharisees were the people's priests, is the way I'll say it. Those are my words. That's where most of the people were, because they wanted to have hope. They wanted to have hope, and they believed in the oral tradition. They were all in the same place. But when you ask that, the first thing that came to my mind, and I want to be careful here, is we have a significant issue going on within the church as a whole, American church in particular, having to do with social justice. I'm not going way down this path, but one of the things that you can see very clearly is that the leadership that's embracing those things that the world wants, guess what? They're rising up and they're promoted. And so this is one of the same things. The Romans liked working with the Sadducees. They probably enjoyed working with the Sadducees because they were just looking about having power now. That's what they were primarily focused on. That's my guess. I don't know that for sure, but I know that they enjoyed a good relationship. And actually, Felix, we'll see in a few, when Paul is brought to Felix, you can decide whether you're going to try somebody where the crime happened or if they're a Roman citizen in their hometown. And Felix says, I'm going to keep him here. One of the reasons was he was trying to please the Jews. Actually, we'll see that next week, not this week.
I think with the oral tradition, too, they could trace it all the way back from rabbi to rabbi to rabbi, all the way back to Moses.
Yeah.
And so they had that kind of weight. And also, we even see it in our culture today. I would rather have a man tell me about the word than go and study it myself.
That's a good point.
And so you do have this same heart
yeah.
there that I would rather you just explain it to me. And we know that the Holy Spirit living inside of us takes that word
and works.
Makes it come alive. And so we are responsible to come to the word ourselves. So.
Yeah, great point. That's a great point. And not only would we rather hear it, but we want to hear it in about 28 minutes and 1.5 speed, you know? It's funny how specific we can actually be now with that. That's interesting. I just wanted to present the difference. The angel piece, I don't know if I finished that out, but there were angels in the Pentateuch that had come. And that's written. So really what they're primarily talking about is eschatology, and the Sadducees did not believe in an afterlife the same way that the Pharisees would. So Paul says, he identifies with the Pharisees, and he says it's because of the resurrection that he's on trial. So was that true? Paul identifies, he says he perceives that there's Sadducees and Pharisees, and that it's because of the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial. And when he says that, is that true? Is he on trial because of the hope and because of the resurrection of the dead?
Depends on the level of causal chain you want to invoke.
Awesome.
So, immediately speaking, he's on trial because the Jews made a ruckus. Beyond that, he's on trial because he's been spreading the good news of Jesus, and he's been spreading the good news of Jesus because of the hope of the resurrection and the life.
Good. So, not just because of the ruckus, but they actually had some specific charges. Would someone look up Acts 21:28? Actually, I'm going to give you two verses. Who can do Acts 21? All right, so 28 and 34. Can someone else do 22? Neil? Acts 22, 24, and 30. Okay? You were 28 and 34. I saw the face.
Acts,
you were like,
wait.
21.
Acts 21, 28, 34?
Yes. Okay. Neil, you got yours?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you. Go ahead, Tim. When you're ready.
Okay. Paul sees in the temple?
Yeah.
Okay. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law in this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place."
Good. And then 34?
And 34. There we go. "But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another, and when he could not find out the fact because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks."
Thank you. So you have two instances. There's a particular charge that, again, that he's violating the temple law, right? He's doing something that is abhorrent to them. But then the second time, it's not really all that clear. Neil?
"The commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. But when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?' When the centurion heard this, the commander told him, saying, 'What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman.' The commander came and said to him, 'Tell me, are you a Roman?' And he said, 'Yes.' The commander said, 'I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money.' And Paul said, 'But I was actually born a citizen.' Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let him go. And the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, because he had put him in chains. But on the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been excused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble and brought Paul down and set him before them."
Thank you. So there's, at the front of that and the back end of that, you see that there's still not clarity there. And if you look at 23, verse 29, it says, this is the letter that he's writing to Felix, the tribune's writing to Felix. He says, "I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving of death or punishment." And so the main point that I wanted to draw out here is that there are some sort of charges against him by the people, but there's a lack of clarity. There is. And again, I think Josh nailed it. There are things that are causative and correlative. And this, the reason that he's on trial is because he's saying Jesus is the fulfillment of what Judaism, the promises that Judaism always saw, right? And the resurrection of the dead, particularly of Christ, is exactly that. And he's saying, this is the reason that I'm on trial, even though they would disagree. And there's an important tension here, because the Jews don't want to allow him to present that as the issue, because the Romans don't care. They don't care what if they're fighting over their law and what happened. It doesn't matter to them. Now, if he's causing riots, the Romans care greatly. And that's where the Jews keep trying to bring that back to. So when we think about Paul saying that, it's totally appropriate. And if you think of when he was in Athens, he did the same thing. He's looking at their statues and he's saying, to this unknown God, let me tell you about him, right? He's Paul's perceptive. He understands what he believes, and he actually understands pretty well what others believe. Actually, in Athens, he actually quotes some of their own poets. And so it's important to just keep in mind to be informed. Again, going back to Chris's sermon this morning, that's the primary thing, right? You can learn everything you possibly could about all these different social issues going on. Yet, if you do not have the biblical filter to figure out what God would call us to do, then you're never going to get to the right answer. And really, the right heart as you approach that. So, all right, I'm going to skip that. Paul claimed to be a Pharisee, right? And Pharisees were loved by the people. Who was not a big fan of Pharisees? Sunday school answer. No, the Sadducees, that's right, a person.
Jesus,
thank you. Yes, Jesus wasn't a fan. We're not going to look at that passage, but Paul brought this out, and Paul wasn't saying, I embrace all the things that the Pharisees embrace. Paul was saying having to do with hope and resurrection from the dead. That's specifically what he was saying. Okay, and then 23:9, all of a sudden the Pharisees are saying that we find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? Why are they mentioning what if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? No, hang on. You're nailing it, so I'll come to you at the end. Let me try to find somebody with a wrong answer or something. No, seriously, why?
The storytellers, so they've already heard his conversion story.
Yes. That's exactly right, because he just said he met Jesus on the Damascus Road. It isn't just a random thing that they're saying. He's saying, hey, we just listened to him say this exact thing. Now, exactly what that was, they're not saying they're fully embracing one way or the other. And actually, specifically, it's dangerous for the Pharisees to agree with Paul in that. We'll look through that further next week. But he's saying that he did meet a spirit. He met Christ on the Damascus Road. And then it's just, you know, consider that the Pharisees and the Sadducees have had this long theological war against one another. Sadducees hold all this power. The Pharisees feel like they're being crushed all the time by this. And now they can actually say, wait a minute, he believes our side, and how quickly they start to embrace what he's presenting. And I would just have us stop and consider, where do we do that in our lives, right? Whether it's theological point or political point or whatever it might be. How quickly those other things come into our lives, because we've identified, we say, yeah, I believe that too. And these other things start to come in with it. And then in Acts 23:11, the same kind of event happens, right? The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for you, as you have testified to the facts of me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. And so this is the promise. What did Jesus promise?
You're going to have to testify in Rome. So you're not done here. You're going to be going elsewhere.
Good. Good. And in what way would he testify in Rome, did it say?
Testify to Jesus to all the Roman soldiers.
Well, not what would happen, but specifically, when you look at that verse 11, what did Jesus promise him? As you have testified to the facts in Jerusalem. So, what does that entail? As you have testified to the facts in Jerusalem?
A trial,
beatings, near death, right? So there's a sense in which Jesus is saying, you're going to make it to Rome, which Paul desires to do. But he's also promising him suffering in the midst of that. And Paul knows that, right? As Paul was coming to Jerusalem, he was told multiple times, there's danger there as you're headed to Jerusalem. And now, right, often when we say, if we think of, we have a promise from God, we think it's just this nice path and everything's going to be okay, right? We can be tempted to do that, I should say. And yet the promise here is combined, you will make it to Rome. But remember what Ananias was told when Ananias was to go to Paul. He will see how much he should suffer for my behalf, right? And this is the fulfillment of that. We see that over and over. So again, it's ironic where the Pharisees believe in these things, and we have Jesus' promise here. All right, I got to start picking up speed.
He says, take courage. And mm-hmm. You need to take courage because this is all ahead of you.
Yeah, yeah. And he's about to head somewhere where he's going to sit in jail for 2 years. I mean, that's, you know, all right, did you really say, I mean, I'd be going over it again. Did he really say Rome? Maybe he said somewhere else, you know, halfway or something. So things aren't necessarily going to get better. In Acts 21:13, it tells us, then Paul answered, what are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? This is what, as he was on his way to Jerusalem. For I am ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. So Paul sees that promise, is excited to go to Rome, and understands the affliction that he'll face as he goes there. So then we have the plot. And as I mentioned before, seemingly, these Jewish plots seem to keep getting revealed. And so the plot is for the council to call Paul, and this is verses 12 to 15. I'm not going to be able to read it. The plot is for the council to call back Paul so that they can examine him again. And there are 40 people who have taken a vow to kill him on the way to this court case, right? That they're going to call Paul back to this. And so there are some stunning things when you consider how, I guess, psychotic, broken, evil, I don't know what the word is, for somebody to consider murdering someone as one individual, it's horrific, and yet we say, okay. But when you think of two people doing that, it becomes, in my mind, just becomes like such a much bigger thing. When you think of 40 men doing that, that's stunning, stunning. And the irony is, what are they doing? They're taking an oath to God to lie and to murder. And why are they doing this? To protect God's honor, right? That's what they're doing. Because Paul is violating things, so they want to protect God by taking an oath to God to lie and murder. And it's deranged when you consider that. And yet, yeah, I mean, we could see it over and over again. Here in Scripture, we see it in the world today, how people get to those places.
First, that they will be thinking that they're doing God's favor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And making good evil and evil good. Yeah. So those Egyptian, the Egyptian leader with the assassins, those are called Sicaris, and they would come, they would have a big impact in Jerusalem, and so those 40 men were likely those same assassins, because this was a kind of a fringe group that hated the Romans, and they hated the Jews who worked with the Romans, and so they called Sicaris because it was a certain kind of dagger that they had, and they would, and when they would kill people, when they would assassinate people. And so they would assassinate Roman soldiers, they would assassinate Jewish leadership, and they're the ones that are likely doing that. Now, they're the conspirators, the accomplices of the chief priests and elders, because they said, yeah, we'll call them, right? But those same Sicaris, Ananias, later in 66, he ends up getting killed by them himself. And actually, the people burn his house down because they hated Ananias. Because he was, like Paul, it's ironic, I think you may have mentioned it last week, like Paul said, God's going to strike you. Well, that happened not that much later. And the people didn't like him because he was a very corrupt man. Those Sicarii are also how the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 happened. Because in 66, they took over the temple and there was a big uproar. Eventually, the Romans came in and wiped out all of Jerusalem because of that group. So chief priests, elders, they were accomplices. And then the witness, you have his nephew who comes and tells him of this plot. And what do we know about the nephew? Paul's nephew, what do we know about him? Nothing. We don't know anything about him. We know that he came and he told Paul. That's it. That's all it says. And sometimes that's what we get in Scripture. And so Paul's nephew comes and says, this plot's going to happen. Paul sends him to the tribune. The tribune says, don't tell anyone, and he makes a plan, okay? So then we're looking at verses 23 to 35, and Acts 23 says, then he called two centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. So he, and this is the protection. So the tribune gives orders for Paul's protection. 470 soldiers are going to protect Paul. So this tribune really liked Paul, right? No. Why was he protecting Paul so much? Why did he want to make sure nothing happened? Wait, we're going to put you on like a little delay.
Could it have been that his life would have been in danger had he let a Roman citizen?
Yes, that's exactly why. Because if he let a Roman citizen be executed in that way, he was going to pay the price. Because now he was the one that was in possession of Paul, right? He had responsibility for Paul. Yes, Josh?
A notable secondary?
Yeah.
If these 40 assassins are Sicarii, as you were suggesting,
mm-hmm.
wiping them out with extreme prejudice would be a feather in his cap.
Would be a what?
Feather in his cap.
Oh, feather in his cap, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Oh, yeah, they would have loved to take them out. But that was like, they say half the contingent that was even in Jerusalem. He wanted to make sure nothing happened to Paul, which I just love God's providence. It's really neat when you watch how this all unfolds. So 470 soldiers. And so there's the communication in verse 26. The tribune's writing to Felix, and he says to him, this man was seized. Is this verse 27 here? This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Is that what happened? No, sort of. He rescued him. He did rescue him. It wasn't exactly the order. He didn't mention that I bound him, right, and that he was about to flog him. He left that part out. But it's just interesting because in later chapters, you see the same thing with Festus, and as they're describing things, they have pretty good memories of themselves, I guess, in that process. So it wasn't exactly true. So the soldiers get him there, and Paul arrives safely before Felix. And then we have verses 34 to 35. And he says, on reading the letter, this is Felix reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So Felix makes the decision that he's going to try him there. They have to wait for the accusers because the Roman law said that somebody accused, the accusers had to come before him and accuse him to his face. And so Felix takes him on and holds him there until they come. And he decided, like I said before, it was pretty much a favor to the Jews for him to not send him to his where he was from. Otherwise, the Jews, that was like, I forget what it was, like 600 miles they would have had travel. This is about 70-ish. And so they would have not been happy. There's another thing that we see in 24. Next week, we're going to look a little bit more detail about Felix, who he is, and examine that court case as we walk through it. And there was, anybody know another reason that Felix might have kept Paul there. At the end of the trial, something happens. Does anyone remember? Awesome. Then you'll have to come next week to find out. So Felix determines that, already went over that. So when we think of the whole picture of what's going on here, Paul is almost killed twice. He's rescued twice by the centurions there. He's brought down by this contingent that, you know, not likely anyone's going to get through them to Paul. And then at the end, he's in, he's kept in Herod's Praetorium, well protected. He's not going to get hurt, right? The Jews want to kill him, and the Romans are making sure that Paul's not going to die right now. But the Jews' desire to kill Paul led him to being rescued twice, escorted by 470 soldiers, and ultimately stayed in the Praetorium. Yet in all this, where was Paul's safety? Why was Paul safe? God kept him safe. There's something I was thinking more specifically, literally a verse that we read in here, in verse 11.
But he had to go to Rome.
Because Jesus said, you will go to Rome. So all of those things, right? Very powerful government with their resources protecting Paul.
Well, the other part of verse 11 is, you know, it said that night the Lord stood by him and said, so we're assuming that there is a physical something, an audible voice, and we're also assuming that Paul was not alone. Somebody in the prison, there was a guard, there was something, and that's where it got. So possibly all of his bodyguards going to Rome was fear of God and everything. The whole process of the Lord's audible voice.
Yeah. No, that God works in those means. Right, God has what he wants him to accomplish, that he will testify to him in Rome, to Christ in Rome, but all along the way, I mean, we're going to see that very clearly, the ways in which he continues to work, to draw people to Paul, for Paul to be able to witness to them. In the Philippian jailer, we saw it there as well. In Deuteronomy 32:39, it says, "See now that I am he. And there is no God beside me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal. There is no one who can deliver from my hand." And one last piece to just consider in this is that Paul's not fighting the Jews, and he doesn't, you know, like, I got to be careful in how I'm saying that, because it would be so hard. These same people are tearing you to pieces and constantly just not listening to what you're saying and trying to kill you. But Paul, remember, was once that exact same man. He knows what the Jews are like. He did that with Stephen. He did that after Stephen. That's where he meets Jesus on the Damascus Road. Because he was in a murderous rage, he was going after the church, right? So Paul was that same thing. He understands what they're like. But they're not his enemy. In Ephesians 6:12, it says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." And so I would just, as I read this, I think about, there seems to be greater tension in our world today, particularly in America, particularly as a Christian. And to keep that concept, that verse in mind, that who it is that we fight, we got to be careful who the enemy becomes. Because that's not ultimately who the enemy is. So next week we'll be going over chapter 24, if you want to read that in advance. Any comments or questions or anything?
So what do you think happened to those 40 people that took it out and said they wouldn't eat anything until they killed him?
So this is what's awesome about Jewish law. You all know this, that there were some caveats to those oaths. And one of the caveats was unless it can't be carried out. So that's pretty sweet. That's a, you know.
So they're off the hook.
Yes. Yes, they were. And I mean, if you think about that, if they're just saying, you know, I took an oath to, whatever. I mean, what kind of oath is that you can just get off it that easy? But they some of the stuff I was reading was showing there were like three or four different ways in which they were fine.
Okay.